I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Lasania Cruz, a Dominican participatory artist, designer, curator, and activist. Through research, oral history, and audience participation, Lasania shapes new pluralistic understandings around the migrant and immigrant experience.
Her latest project, Obituaries of the American Dream, commissioned by New York's El Museo del Barrio, invites participants locally and globally, non-immigrants and immigrants alike, to share when and how did the American dream die for you?
At this incredibly divisive time, Lasania is helping us understand differences amongst people of all backgrounds, and particularly understanding how migrants and immigrants profoundly shape what it means to be American. Getting away from the idea of the monolithic experience, Lasania celebrates and explores diversity in its many forms. Let's get her on the line. Hi, Lasania. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Hi, how are you?
Wanted to begin with, what is at the top of your mind right now?
I'm actually thinking that at this moment that I didn't tell my neighbors that I was going to record audio. So I should have texted them before.
Well, part of it is we're interviewing people in their homes, so
yeah.
there may be some home sounds.
Yeah, I guess in a bigger picture, I've been thinking about the difference between the word integrated and assimilation. Mm. And it's kind of like a big thought, but yes, last night I was part of a study group with the National Women Liberation Movement. And we were discussing the importance of integrated movement building. And a lot of women in the conversation had like a visceral reaction to integration, including myself, because as immigrants, I think we associate integration with assimilation. And I've been trying to think about the difference because there are like true difference, but we've been conditioned to think that in order to integrate, we have to assimilate to a different culture.
Yeah. And of course, you know, when it comes to indigenous culture, that's a whole other conversation as well.
Yeah. We were just talking about, yeah, kind of like the power of coalition. And I guess like that was also coalition immediately referenced movement building and political work. And I think that they were trying to move away from that and use a word like integration. Mm. But there's so much baggage in the word itself. So
it seems like they're talking about you have to adjust yourself, that it's integration requires sort of it's asymmetrical.
Yeah. But I guess in the word integration, there is like a way of acknowledging our differences and kind of working together in that acknowledgement. And I think that is like a huge thing right now.
For sure.
So I've been kind of just thinking about that this morning. And
So where are you speaking to us from? Where do you live?
I live in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. Mm.
Integration's a part of that neighborhood too.
Well, that's tricky. That is for sure tricky, I think. But I would say gentrification is part of this neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I guess that's like, again, the challenge with the word, right? Mm. That it has been co-opted into a different way of thinking of like really not about sharing power, but of like power over, right? So
yeah, come from the school system, the integrated schools, you know, especially in Brooklyn, this idea of, that's what I mean by asymmetrical, this idea that they're not really meeting on equal terms. They're sort of allowing something.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have kids and I don't know what the process of like being part of the school system here in New York is, but I imagine that is it's complicated. Just trying to make sure that you're really integrated in a school and it's really multiracial and there's like a differences of experiences.
What has 2020 been like for you? You know, the pandemic, the calls for social justice, the election, both personally and professionally.
2020 has been, I guess, like in the very much like cliche word, it has been like actually 2020 vision in a way. I think also it has been a moment of like understanding the importance of pause and why. For me personally, I had sort of like a moment of understanding that I was like part of this gear, that I was always moving and I never had the opportunity, even though I thought I was being critical, to really see things from a different perspective. So I think it has been about that. It has been about thinking more deeply around interdependency. This year, when the pandemic hit, it's funny enough, Judith Butler just launched a book this year on like the force of nonviolence. And I started reading that and it was kind of like a shifting moment for me to understand interdependency and the relationship with violence and communities and how we perceive ourselves. So I think like that shift has been happening for me for a while, but really 2020 was kind of like the last drop, I guess, in a way.
When it comes to immigration and migration, sort of focal points of your work, both as an artist and as a curator, could you share what your thoughts are on the current sort of build the wall Trump White House, and also what you think a Biden presidency might look like in terms of immigration policy?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I feel like I'm in a place where I cannot think yet about a Biden administration. And maybe this is wrong for me. Like, I'm actually trying to think more further out of the Biden administration. And what does it mean to have countries that are interdependent to each other and as we are now, but that we are really living in a world that is interdependent and recognizing this?
Well, in the past year, you've been collecting testimonies from people in the U.S. and abroad around your project, Obituaries of the American Dream. Can you tell us a bit about this and how it got started? What was the driver for the project?
Yeah, I was invited by the El Museo del Barrio to be part of the triennial. And they wanted me to think about, sort of in response to the pandemic and what was happening at the time. And again, like as I was saying, I think that I was thinking of interdependency and I was trying to push myself away from individualism. And I was trying to kind of reckon with this idea, who is the American dream for? The reality is that I was able to practice my work because I have a specific type of documentation that I was able to pay for.
Of course.
And I guess like those are the things that are like the structural things. Yeah, of course. Like the reason why we're in New York is because you're in the subway with everyone. And that's like the beauty and sort of like the high of being in a city like this.
Yeah.
But I guess it's like the structural things behind it and that for me to think that I'm able to obtain the American dream based on the opportunities that I have diminish the structural barriers that all people face.
Absolutely.
So I think that's why I've been interested in how can we actually dismantle this idea, to move forward.
Well, it's monolithic, and it assumes that there's something that applies to everyone, and it just doesn't. And that's why we wanted to have you on the program today, because you're unpacking that idea. I mean, that's a lot of what we talk about here is, you know, we were in a conversation yesterday with a brilliant, brilliant woman who pairs very well with this episode, Aslam Sekik, and she was the first immigrant person of color, Muslim, as a member of parliament in Denmark. Mm. And, you know, a lot of what we were speaking about with her is about this sort of monolithic idea between the left and the right. Mm. And specifically that, you know, your American dream is entirely different, obviously, from mine, from my wife's, from my 12-year-old, you know, mm-hmm. the American dream is specific to everyone. And it is a complete mythology that there's some rule writ large that will allow anyone, as if it's a meritocracy. Of course it isn't. It's not structured to be. And I imagine, and what we want to talk to you about today is what you've been finding from speaking to so many different people. How varied those stories are.
Yeah, it's storytelling and it's narrative and it's who has the power to tell the stories the loudest, and that sort of shapes a collective narrative.
Yeah.
What are some of the conversations that have really struck you, that have really made you think?
One big conversation, for instance, was the first week we launched a project. The project is a website, right? It started as a website. It will be a newspaper next year. But I work with a developer to set up the forms, and we just use sort of like the standard forms for developing. Funny enough, just like, you know, things of the world, the project was for a Puerto Rican museum, like a museum that's based, that was funded by Puerto Rican artists. So when we launched the project, Puerto Rican people that were trying to participate could not say that their nationality was Puerto Rican because we use the standard coding in the form, which means that Puerto Rico is a territory of the U.S., is not recognized as a nationality. So that sparked a very interesting conversation, both of like the form of the project, but also just as like these U.S. territories, right? And the importance of freedom and what is freedom, who has the right to freedom, who has the right to equal opportunity, and that you cannot even on a standard form have the freedom to identify as a nation. So that was like a really interesting conversation that happened just from following or not being completely mindful of all the ways these structures are in place in our everyday life.
Hmm. Well, I was just curious, you know, did your perspective shift throughout the pandemic in this project, your own personal perspective on the American dream? So I was curious where it started and where it is now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my perspective of work really shifted during the pandemic. And I was questioning why I was valuing work so much. Why do I put so much value in my practice and not think as equally in my interpersonal relationships? And it was actually a hard thing for me because I started to realize like I had to kind of think like, have I missed out on other personal things just because I've been so focused on getting work done? So I think that that's also why one of the reasons what made me do this project, because I think also part of this narrative of the American dream is that if you work hard enough, you can make it. I think another big part of it was that I was, to be honest, I didn't necessarily believe in universal healthcare and universal programs and the safety net of the government. And I still don't have the language to explain why. And I think part of it I attribute to the American dream. Like, I believe that I could make dues and afford those things. Mm. And I think throughout the pandemic, I realized how false this is. And I was like, wow, I should have been behind Bernie way back. Like, I lost so much time on this. And I, at the same time, I was doing another study group with the National Women Liberation Movement, who is like an org that I've been sort of more involved after the pandemic as well. And we were doing a study group on universal programs. And I started to realize my different biases around universal programs and how relationships of race come into play with that as well. So I think those things have deeply shifted. And I want to start thinking more about, if I'm paying taxes, what are the things that the government should provide for, mm-hmm. for me and my community, because I'm also contributing to this pot.
Mm. What has your work, you know, around migration and immigration taught you about its effects on culture, on society, and on peoples?
For me, I go back to this question to think about Glisson and Edric Glisson, and mm-hmm. when he talks about the diaspora as like a person of multitudes. And I think that, again, going back to this idea of pushing against a monolithic, I think immigrants, migrants, like, we are people of multitudes because we have connections to our homeland, we have connections to the place that we live, to the community that we are part of. So I think that has taught me about this importance of multiplicity within the self, and how do we create spaces that allow us to show up in those multiples?
Mm. It's like the self is a tapestry or something.
Exactly. Yeah. The self is a tapestry. I don't know. I also just finished reading Glitch Feminism and also thinking about the self as a glitch. So yeah, it's a book by Legacy Russell. And yeah, I think that just in our ability to create culture and society, we have the ability to create multiplicity and plurality.
Mm. Immigrant communities, particularly in the U.S., have been so vulnerable and hard hit by COVID-19, whether because of poverty, limited access to healthcare, fear of legal repercussions. Could you speak to what you've heard or seen in terms of this and sort of the impact that the pandemic has been having on these communities?
Yeah, I think it's terrible. And at the same time, I think that there's like some things to be learned. Like, I've been collaborating with a group, the Center for Family Life, and they have a program called the Sanctuary Family, which is supporting families that their parents are being in the process of removal, and to have conversations with their kids about what are the things that they need to put in place in order to have a guardian for their child. And they've been hardly hit there in Sunset Park, but yet they have like created a network of resilience and collaboration and, you know, food pantry, but also sharing resources. Mm-hmm. I also think that there's a big part of the domestic industry that was hit by the ways that people were not compensating domestic workers during COVID. And I think that these things will have like larger repercussions. Mm. And I don't know if we'll be able to tell like at the moment, because as we are hitting into what seems like a second wave,
yeah.
You know, I remember in the mid mid-June, there was like an article in the New York Times about the Hispanic paradox, which is like this idea that in Hispanic communities, you know, even though they're among the most marginalized and have like the lower income levels, their life expectancy is really high. So is it because of like the close-knit among communities and family members? Is it because of faith? I don't know. So the author at this op-ed was talking about what can we learn from the Hispanic paradox, and what are the different ways that we can learn about this like interwoven community network. So, but I think that unfortunately the immigrant community has been hit super hard, and I don't know. Like it just feels, at the beginning of the pandemic, I was reaching out to organizers across New York that I had been collaborating. And I think a lot of them were very much in a reaction mode of trying to build mutual aid, trying to build like networks of care for everyone. And I think that that work happened and is happening, but I wonder about the sustainability of it. So, yeah, I think that we haven't seen yet what is the impact.
Well, and beyond COVID, we have this other crisis, the climate crisis, that's increasingly affecting immigrant communities and leading to significant climate migration.
Yeah.
From your knowledge, in what ways have you found the climate crisis to be impacting immigrants?
Well, I don't know. I feel like in the future, we're all going to be immigrants because of the climate crisis. Yeah, I don't know actually how to answer this question because I just started working on something last year, a project around looking at migration from like a climate perspective. And I wanted to focus on New Orleans because in New Orleans, something interesting happened after Katrina. A lot of Black communities had to leave New Orleans, but then there was like an influx of Hondurans and South Americans immigrants that came into New Orleans to rebuild New Orleans and stayed. So I've been interested in looking at the movement of people and thinking about, we often don't think of a state border as a migration per se in the US. So what would happen if we start looking at state borders as well? As, you know, people from Florida will not be able to live in Florida.
Right. Maine is going to become a very desirable place to live.
It's a fascinating idea because when you look at just what happened during the pandemic, this sort of statehood and the state power and the kind of division, it's like, it's kind of extraordinary. Forget moving countries. We have problems moving state by state under crisis.
Exactly.
That's really fascinating. Well, I mean, on this topic, in 2044, America's projected as being a majority white nation. By 2060, 28% of the U.S. will be Hispanic. 2065, there will be 107 million Latinos, one in every five Americans. How do you think this will shape the United States culturally, socially, and politically? And how aware do you think people are at this time of what's coming, the changes that are occurring?
Oh, I think they're absolutely aware. I mean, we have Trump in power. So I don't think that this is like a coincidence. They know that we're here. You know, I've been reading a lot about the Beacons Revolution, which I didn't know anything at all. Like I didn't learn in school or anything. So
teach us.
No, I don't want to teach you. For me, a lot of the reading I've been doing around this is about how the Beacon Revolution was sort of like the initiation of whiteness as like a race, and how whiteness was used to divide the labor movement and like the working class of that era, which was like indentured labor, which could be white or black, and enslaved people. So the only reason why I mentioned that is because I fear that if there's not a deeper understanding of this issue of whiteness in this country, and I say we, although I live here, but I'm not American, like we are not going to be able to move forward with having, you know, like a fully integrated or multiracial country. Mm. And I think those projections are, I don't know, I question those projections. And at the same time, I think that they're a true possibility. But what happens in pandemics? What happens to the life expectancy in that projection? I don't know who's.
Yeah, I mean, who's president could change.
Yeah,
things,
who's, you know? President? Exactly. So I feel that the material conditions of that projection are so unknown. And I want to go back to, again, these understanding of like, how could it be rooted in really history in order for that to change?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to finish on the subject of storytelling. You have this project, We the News, which documents, publishes, and distributes the stories of Black immigrants and migrants and first-generation Black Americans. Could you talk about that project and also the role of storytelling that you see in within the context of, you know, everything we've been discussing, really? Like, how important and key is the narrative, is the act of storytelling?
I mean, I think it's huge. Storytelling from the beginning of ages, that's how we understand people, that's how we understand the world. And it's not only the stories, you know, it's like the stories in literature, but it's like the stories that are given down from like our ancestors to our grandparents.
Oral history,
yeah, exactly. So I like to think about storytelling as like a way that people would understand us when we're no longer here. And that's why I think that We the News for me was important to start as a project, because at the time I was feeling that, again, the immigration narrative was very monolithic and there was like aspects of it that were being missed. And I wanted to figure out a way that create a space where people could share their stories from like the first perspective. And that could also intervene the public space and have access to the same thing a newsstand has access, because who determines that this is news versus not? I mean, of course, this is not under like a journalistic approach, but I'm just trying to figure out who determines what gets published or not, who determines what is visible or not. So I think with We the News, it was. And I think that the part with storytelling as well is like the ability of creating language. Mm-hmm. And language could be multitude of things. Like I think for We the News specifically was a language around Blackness and what Blackness means as an immigrant in the U.S. And what I mean is like what Blackness means outside of the U.S. and once you come into the U.S. context. And for me personally, I didn't have that language to myself, because when I moved here, I was pushed to prescribe to a monolithic narrative of Blackness. And I think that as a Dominican woman, that looks very different. So I think that that's also one of the importance of storytelling, this ability to create language. And what better way to allow folks to create their own language and to share that?
Hmm. So final question, what is giving you the most hope right now as we find our way toward the end of 2020 and hopefully emerge out of this pandemic sometime next year?
For me, what's giving me most hope is like maybe groups that are organized and been doing the work for so long and are still excited and trying to fight the work and push the movement forward. I think that another thing that has given me hope too is just seeing something like Black Lives Matter and the difference of leadership in that movement, where it's not that the leaders are front and center and it's like three women that have started this movement, gives me a lot of hope as well. And I think also just sharing food with friends gives me a lot of hope in this time. You know, like I live close by one of my best friends and we like to cook a lot and, you know, we bring each other leftovers. And that gives me hope, that idea that we are able to do that.
Leftovers as a metaphor is really nice.
But sharing them, you know, like sharing care with people you love and just sharing food is something that gives me hope on a daily.
Mm. Lasagna, this is so great. Thank you for your time today. We really enjoyed speaking with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you, guys. And I'm looking forward to speaking more.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.